Hi, I'm Brian McCreep, and this is the Answered Question from WCRB in Boston for March 10th, 2017. It's a podcast about creativity through music in the voices of musicians you hear on the air each weekend on WCRB. Couldn't resist bringing you a small part of Bach's B minor Mass to kick off this podcast. There have been a lot of chances to hear this piece this season, and now you can hear this one on demand. This is Boston Baroque, led by Martin Perlman, in concert last October. It's a performance we featured on WCRB in concert last Sunday night, and you'll find it at our website, classicalwcrb.org. You can also find last weekend's Boston Symphony broadcast there with the first and third symphonies by Brahms available on demand. Again, that's all at classicalwcrb.org. As for this weekend, the BSO is back from their tour to New York, Toronto, and Montreal, and the program we'll have for you live on the air tomorrow night starts with the third symphony by Sibelius, and then it goes to the piano concerto by Busoni. As you'll hear in a minute from the conductor, Sakari Oramo, those two pieces have some deeply intertwined connections. And on Sunday night, Alan McClellan brings you the Takash Quartet on WCRB in concert. It's an all Beethoven program. And on this podcast, you'll hear about it and about the ensemble itself from Edward Dusenberry, the group's first violinist. So if you've never heard of the piano concerto by Ferruccio Busoni, that would be understandable. It's not done too often, mostly because the solo part is close to impossible, but also because it includes a men's chorus in the last movement. And beyond that, it's an hour and 15 minutes long. In other words, it's a big commitment for an orchestra to schedule it. The Boston Symphony has never done it, even though the composer was a pretty regular guest soloist for about 20 years in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And he even taught for a few years at the New England Conservatory. This weekend, the BSO is doing the Busoni Piano Concerto with soloist Kirill Gerstein, but when I met with conductor Sakari Oramo this week after a rehearsal, I asked him first about the piece that precedes the Busoni, the Third Symphony by Sibelius, and specifically, whether Sibelius is still considered the national hero in Finland that he was decades ago.
I think he is revered, and Sibelius is, for Finnish people and actually for all humanity, he's something so incredibly unique and great and sort of an own voice in the huge medal of romantic symphonic music, if you like. Sibelius was both a traditionalist and a sort of wall breaker. He did both very conservative things and incredibly advanced things, which even composers nowadays learn from, and you know, how to make sections kind of join into each other without any borders, etc. And I mean, he was a kind of a big searching talent, I think. Wanted always to find something new in his music.
And with the Third Symphony, it's kind of more modest than some of his other works. So what is it about the Third that really, what does it tell us about Sibelius?
Sibelius talked later in his life about the Third Symphony as being my least loved child, which didn't mean that he himself loved it least. He actually conducted it quite a lot, many times, and I think it was a very important piece for him. But he felt that the musical world hadn't kind of grasped the piece as they had grasped his other, basically almost all of his other symphonies. And it's probably due to the fact, as you say, that the Third Symphony is much more modest in duration, in orchestration, in musical language. It's almost spare compared to the second and the first and the massive early works. And this brings us to the relation between Sibelius and Busoni, because Busoni was the one who actually convinced Sibelius to sort of find a new style, which would have less notes, which would be kind of more crisp and clear and transparent. And in the character of the Third Symphony, there is a recent discovery which opens quite a lot of the piece. Until recently, it's been sort of thought of as a kind of slightly folkloristic piece of music, but actually the musical material comes from an unfinished oratorio, which Sibelius planned to write. There is a full libretto to it, but there is no single sketch, musical sketch to it. I think he decided not to write it after all. He wasn't a religious person at all in terms of those days. But he talked about the Third Symphony as being a kind of religious, mystical, spiritual work in the popular sense. So one could think it's a kind of naive belief in deity and in God and in something that is above us. And I think that's what makes, kind of opens the piece in a completely new way and gives it much more horizon than just this kind of slightly folkloristic, lighter piece.
So is this discovery that we didn't know about this oratorio before, or it was just discovered that this music would have been intended for? What is it that now unlocks this mystery for us?
Well, it's just there are some scholars who've sort of been on the case for quite a long time, and I mean the plan for the oratorio has been kind of in the knowledge, but the connection hasn't. And it has only recently appeared that there are actually connections between the oratorio planned and this piece, the Third Symphony, and also his fantastic tone poem for soprano and orchestra, Luonnotar, which also was written in the same period.
Ah, well, that's fantastic. I didn't realize that. And it also maybe strengthens this relationship between the Third Symphony and the Piano Concerto by Busoni, which has its own sort of spirituality, but kind of ill-defined and broad and all over the place. So just to talk about that piece, and we'll come back to the connection between the two in a few minutes. There is so much going on in this Busoni Piano Concerto. It's almost mind-boggling how much there is to grapple with. And because it's so rarely heard, I just wonder, from your own perspective as a conductor, how long did it take you to begin to feel like you had a handle and that it made coherent sense to you?
Well, it took longer than normally, I would say, with a piece of such length and difficulty. This is not the first time for me that I do the piece, but it's the first time with Kirill Gerstein as soloist. And of course, the soloist is really a decisive factor in this piece. The conductor cannot go sort of without being in agreement, at least broadly, with the soloist. But it is like a symphonic work with a very important piano part. And the orchestra gets a lot of fantastic things to play. But holding this kind of piece together, of course, as a sort of musical entity requires, I think, something more than just analysis and kind of even more than understanding the intentions. You almost have to be kind of spiritually in a sort of calm state so that you can find your way through these twists and turns without being too much rocked by it. So it should be kind of, I think there is a sense of calmness around all this huge activity that there is in the piece. And what I find really endearing about the Busoni Piano Concerto is how he brings on Italian, quintessentially Italian popular music. Again, a reference to Sibelius and what he did in his music, of course, on a totally different cultural level. But I mean, there is the Italian marching band, the military band, you know, and combining these very Italian elements to this sort of broad a philosophical universe, which is very German-based, I think, and Busoni was felt home in Bolzano, which is a city where they speak two languages, Italian and German, are equally important, and I think he was very much felt a part of the sort of German philosophical circle, if you like.
I love how you're describing this, because maybe it indicates to the audience that when you hear things that you might normally in a piece of music feel like are hooks or references to other things and you can construct some reality out of it, maybe just let go of all that. Maybe just let this piece come to you as it comes and not worry about the references that come up in your head, maybe.
Yeah, certainly. And I think the sort of the rich bundle of references that you will come out with from this performance is going to kind of feel almost like a relaxing event. rather than something where you have to strain yourself very much.
Right. So the piece brought a question to my mind, which is, I hadn't really thought about it with other pieces, but it feels like there are some works that we hear from orchestras that feel relevant today as much as they were when they were new. And maybe the most obvious thing is Beethoven symphonies. We always find relevance in Beethoven symphonies. And then there are other pieces that feel more like time capsules, like they're from another time. We have to travel to that time. Do you feel like this Busoni Piano Concerto fits into one or the other of those categories?
I think it's very relevant, but I can't quite put my finger on why it is relevant. Of course, not in the way that a Beethoven symphony is, or say even a Verdi opera, which is also universally relevant because the stories are so human and heartbreaking. This is more, it's about a sort of optimistic endeavor to become, you know, calm and better. And in that sense, it could be very, very relevant for our time if the person in our time has the sort of patience at time and time to listen to the music as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, it's on a different scale from how we experience things these days, but I really like that. Thank you. That actually helps me understand maybe a different way of framing it, that when we give ourselves into that piece, it does have a relevance for dealing with today's world in a certain way. The fact that that Sibelius III and the Busoni Piano Concerto are on the same program, I wondered, you've already explained some of the connection, but they're also written at almost the same time. And so there's something about them together that tells us about different ways of looking at the world that happen simultaneously.
Yeah, Busoni and Sibelius were great friends since their youth, actually, and as it happens, before coming to Boston, because Busoni spent 3 years in Boston teaching at the NEC, he taught in Helsinki, of all places, which was at the time a small village in the outskirts of the Russian Empire, and I mean, totally unlikely, but when I studied, when I was younger, I studied at Sibelius Academy, and where you enter the concert hall, there were two busts, two heads. One was Sibelius, obviously, and the other one was Busoni. They were kind of framing the door where you enter to make your appearance on the concert hall stage. And so Busoni is a very familiar figure to us, although his time in Finland was very, very brief. And I think they somehow clicked very well together emotionally, and Busoni was a sort of great personality in helping other composers to sort of find new ways. He also helped Nielsen. The second symphony of Nielsen is dedicated to Busoni. So that could be another possible option to pair with the piano concerto, which I did in London a couple of years ago. But Sibelius seemed even more important in this case.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought up the Sibelius Academy. Just to wrap up, I'm curious about your experience and your perspective as a conductor that came up through that system, and the fact that Finnish conductors are known around the world for just all kinds of great qualities. What is it about? Is it really down to Jorma Panula, who is the great teacher there, or is there something more going on in Finland that produces such great conductors all the time?
Well, I've thought about it a lot because I'm being asked this question all the time, and I mean, from my own experience, what I found really important is when you come to the conductor's class, you are already a finished musician. So you have to be a master of an instrument. So studying conducting with Jorma Panula there, he's retired now, but when he was there, it wasn't, you know, learning how to read a score. It wasn't learning how to analyze music. It was purely and simply the practical work of standing in front of an orchestra twice a week, every week, with new repertoire, being able to sort of handle the situation psychologically. And that's what he held in very big, big esteem. He always kept saying, speak nicely to the orchestra, show you appreciate them, and all that. And of course, you know, it's very abstract, but it helped a lot. And he gave the sort of technical basis and foundation of conducting, but also simultaneously the sort of contact with an orchestra part, which is not learnable if you don't have an orchestra to conduct. And that's, I think, the big key secret. And of course, Sibelius Academy has continued to issue issue internationally. Renowned conductors, way after Panula left. In Leif Segerstam's time, he was professor there, and now Atzo Almila is doing a very good job as well. And it's kind of, it's going on still, even without Panula. But of course, Panula set it all up. I mean, he's the sort of great doyen of teaching, conducting, I think all over the world, actually.
Yeah. Well, I'm thrilled you're back in Boston. I know you've been here just one time before, so
yes, as a conductor, I've been otherwise here quite a lot. Quite a lot, but sometimes.
I should say to the Boston Symphony, right? But you've been here to Boston, so anyway, it's great to have you back, and I'm so glad you're doing this really fascinating program. Thanks for taking a few minutes to talk with me.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Zachary Aramo leads the Boston Symphony in two performances this week. The first is this afternoon, and the second will be live on the radio tomorrow night, beginning at 8 p.m. On Sunday at 7 p.m., Alan McClellan is your host for WCRB in concert with the Takash Quartet in an all-Beethoven concert presented by Rockport Music. Alan got together with first violinist Edward Dusenberry to talk about the concert, the ensemble, and the book Dusenberry wrote a couple of years ago about Beethoven and playing with the Takash. And they started by talking about the transition as the group's original founding first violinist retired.
My predecessor was wonderful founding first violinist Gabor Tokács Nagy, who was at the formation of the group in 1975 in Budapest. And so I replaced him in 1993, but he's now very active as a conductor and a teacher.
What was that like to begin or to join a group that was already formed and happening and all colleagues and friends?
It was a crazy adventure. I was fresh out of school at Juilliard. And maybe when you're that age, you're a little more cocky and able to take chances. And I must say that the others were very nice to me. They never patronized me or said, well, you know, we've been doing this for 18 years, so we don't suggest that musical idea. They kind of let me find my way of doing things. So that's the only reason it worked, really.
And the other non-original member of the ensemble is Geraldine Wolfer. But she's not even the second violist of the ensemble. How did that history go?
That's right. Well, the founding violist, Gabor Ormai, I worked with him for only 18 months. And tragically, he died of cancer very suddenly in 1995. And then for 10 years, our violist was the English violist Roger Tapping, who actually relocated to Boston after that and is now the violist of the Juilliard Quartet. And then Jerry joined us. Now it's nearly 11 years ago, actually more than 11 years ago. And she had been principal viola of San Francisco Symphony for 29 years before she joined us.
You have written a book about the experience of joining this ensemble, and I must say I'm so impressed with how deeply personally you've presented this and how thoroughly you've thought about all the issues around string quartets and Beethoven and joining the string quartet. The book is called Beethoven for a Later Age, Living with the String Quartets. We can talk about that a little bit later. Tonight's program is Beethoven, all Beethoven. And you've done, as I say, just a lot of thinking about this music. How do you go about communicating that thought and that intense thought to the audience sitting, hearing this perhaps for the first time?
An old Beethoven concert is a special animal. And we always try and do, as of this evening, an early and a more of a middle piece and a later one, so that you can see the incredible evolution between the pieces, which is not to say that the first Opus 18, one of his early quartets, it's already a masterpiece. It's just that you hear much more the influence of Haydn and Mozart, and especially their Mozart, I mean Haydn's humor. But then Opus 95 is a completely different world, nicknamed the Serioso, not even really intended for a general audience. And it's full of these kind of harsh changes of mood, very sudden changes of mood, very terse, kind of explosive piece of music. And then Opus 131 is probably, if I had to choose one, my favorite and many people's favorite of Beethoven's quartets, written right at the end of his life. An amazing piece in seven movements with no breaks between the movements. So again, incredible changes of mood between the movements, but somehow it all hangs together. And I think whenever we're playing a Beethoven program, we're just trying to tap into that amazing spirit of innovation and fantasy that runs throughout his music. And of course, it's a little bit of a contradiction because we have to rehearse very hard. We have to know what we're doing and exactly what's happening next. And yet at the same time, we try to recreate it in a way that it has elements of surprise and fantasy in it.
So there are all these technical details that you have to think about, and yet the experience you want the audience to have is something perhaps that has different, totally different meaning for them.
Yeah, and the great thing about Beethoven quartets particularly is that audience members can experience them in very different ways, and you can have a tremendous emotional spectrum over the evening. You might feel very soothed in a particular place and a bit disoriented and uncomfortable in another, and it's our job as performers to try and bind those different elements together for an audience. And I suppose I feel quite reassured to be playing Beethoven. There's some solace in playing, especially the Opus 131 at the moment, because there is someone working with incredibly diverse material within a piece of music. I mean, different types of characters. Sometimes it's sublime and religious. Sometimes it's the simplest folk tune. And yet his goal and our goal is to kind of bind these things together, not to have them as fractured elements. And I think that's something that, especially at this time, we can all pay attention to.
Right, binding things together,
yeah.
In general, yeah. I wanted to go back just a bit to the Opus 18, number 2 that you're playing. These have all the reflections of his teacher, Haydn. But how is it like Haydn, or how is it like Mozart?
Well, I think what strikes me about Haydn is the witty dialogue between the instruments. So you can hear, and there's almost a competitive element. You'll hear someone playing a tune, and then someone else kind of chipping in with a little comment and then taking over the tune. And another aspect in the last movement, which is full of fun and games, very high-spirited, there are also these pauses, suddenly where the music comes to a stop and you wonder what's going to happen next. And that's very much a characteristic of Haydn's, his kind of dramatic approach. Mozart, I'm more reminded of in the slow movement, which has a wonderful operatic lyrical quality to it in its outer sections, and then a rather sassy little middle section that seems to have nothing whatsoever to do with the slow music. So that's a sort of funny combination of Haydn and Mozart right there.
And then the Opus 95, this is the second one that you're going to do in F major, is one that Beethoven said should never be performed in public. Why wouldn't he have wanted to hear it ever?
I think, yeah, it's a bit of a mystery, and it's quite funny that everyone's just ignored that comment. I mean, it was public. It took a while for the piece to be published, but ever since then, everyone's been playing it. It's just rather uncompromising. It's not a piece that is really intended to please. The way it starts off, it's rather sort of angry and almost aggressive, if you like. And even the slow movement doesn't have quite the same soothing sense or transporting sense that some of his expansive slow movements do. It's an allegretto, and therefore it's just kind of it flows in a way that is sometimes a little bit restless and disturbed. So there's never any real sense of peace. And the third movement is just relentless. I mean, it's a relentless rhythm kind of drummed over and over again. I think it was one of my very favorite endings to the whole piece. After a kind of an agitato, disturbed last movement, he turns it into a kind of a very, very light, frivolous Rossini ending, extremely fast, as if all this kind of angst and F minor storminess, he's kind of just making fun of at the end and kind of blowing it off. And it does seem like a very satirical ending. He's either making fun of the audience, or perhaps he's making fun of Rossini and that type of very light music. But it's definitely ironic. It's not intended to be somehow a very satisfying, virtuosic last movement like one of the 59 quartets. There's a real sense of irony in it, I think.
He'd known about his deafness for a long time by then, so he was a little cynical.
Yeah, I think it, and he was probably very aware of the pressure. I mean, the whole concert scene was changing, and you know, he wanted to have a big audience for his symphonies. He might put on a concert with all of his works, and it was kind of critical that he sold tickets. This was no longer, he was no longer really completely protected by aristocratic patrons. And yet he fought against that. He could write crowd pleasers. In fact, right after that piece, several years later, he wrote this, you know, this ridiculous piece, really, Wellington's Victory, which was all about the, to celebrate the, at that time, they thought the end of the Napoleonic Wars, and it was performed great success in Vienna, with sort of different sections, the French entrance and the British entrance and march and battle and victory. It was a real crowd pleaser, very, very successful. But he could do that, but there was another side to his personality that really resisted having to please audiences, please patrons, please players. So he had a group of close friends that he and followers that he knew would kind of allow him to write whatever he wanted to. And so I think in this piece, he was sort of writing for them and trying to resist the pressure to be popular.
And he could thumb his nose at Rossini all he liked in private performances.
Exactly, exactly.
And then this Opus 131, written just a year before he died, and that was his favorite as well. I mean, it's a lot of people's favorites. Schumann wrote this eloquent quote that I read, and Schubert said no one ever should ever write any more music because he's written it all. What would you say is it that makes that true?
I think that the emotional spectrum is one thing. It starts very unusually with a very deeply felt slow movement, a fugal opening where each voice comes in one at a time, joining each other, and then the beautiful transition into a very sort of fleeting spring-like second movement. The fourth movement is one of his great variation movements that starts with a very simple theme, and the degree in which this theme or the harmonies that the theme's based on are kind of transformed. Well, the harmonies stay very similar, but the number of different characters and colors and textures that he creates, it's like a really good play, in the sense that you start with a character, the theme, and then by the end, the character's sort of been transformed, so that when you hear the theme come back at the end of the movement, it sounds completely different in terms of the character of the music and the way it's presented. And I think we get in that movement particularly this incredible sense of improvisation and fantasy that he was proud of. He very modestly said that there was less lack of fantasy than in his previous works. And that's a really an understatement.
And you've taken on Beethoven in this book, but much more than that, it's kind of a memoir of your own experience. Again, it's Beethoven for a later age, living with the string quartets. And why did you write this book?
Well, I, from an early stage after I joined the Tocatsch, I felt like a pretender when I joined the group. You know, I was inexperienced. I was playing with much older colleagues. And one of the things that I did to try and gain confidence in a way was I read as much as I could around the pieces that we were playing. And I got very interested in the story of Beethoven's first players and the first patrons. And it was reassuring to me because sometimes we think, oh, Beethoven, you know, he's this great central pillar of classical music, and therefore we should be able to understand everything he writes. But I was finding that some of this music's quite difficult to understand first time round. And it was reassuring to me to find out that the first players and the first audiences of the Opus 59s or the later quartets, they also had a lot of difficulty with them. And the performances weren't always successful. And so when, as a young quartet player, when I felt the spotlight was shining rather ferociously on me, it was reassuring to think that I was part of this longer tradition of players and audiences that have been dealing with this challenging music for the last 200 years. And so I started to think, after I'd been in the quartet for 15 plus years, that I wanted to tell a story about the Tocatsch Quartet, what it was like to join, the various ups and downs that any group has to go through over a long career, But I didn't want the book just to be a memoir. I think there are a lot of classical musicians who actually write very well in that style. So I really wanted to tie it back to the first audiences, the kind of sense of how these pieces were created, and maybe to give a little bit more sense, therefore, of the process that went into that, that they came about because of particular players and particular patrons. It wasn't just a matter of Beethoven's genius, and bringing it up to our story, that of course when you hear a concert, you want to feel that it's a finished product in some sense. That's what an audience doesn't expect it to be, to feel like a rehearsal. And yet from our perspective, we're always tweaking things and changing things. There's an ongoing process at work from one night to the next even. And so I tried to give some sense of that in the book as well.
Yeah, I think you do so beautifully because, you know, when you are in a quartet and you're dealing with the Beethoven string quartets, as you would have to with any string quartet, it's an ongoing process, as you say. I don't want to embarrass you, but I think that perhaps you've done it in your book, so I'll ask you to do it in person, to talk about your colleagues a little bit, because they are especially talented, and they have come together in kind of a special history. Your second violinist, Carolee, is more of an exuberant personality, and how does that play out when you work together?
I think when I first went and worked with the then three Hungarians in Boulder, Colorado, where we're still based, I was struck by their sort of warmth of personality. And, you know, when you're at a music school, you do spend a lot of time kind of trying to correct mistakes. And if you're doing competitions as a young player, that's very much on your mind. I think that it was very liberating for me to work with these Hungarian musicians who... There's always a sense of adventure and warmth and humor in their approach, not just Kocsi, I mean also Ondrasz and then Gábor Ormai. And so I hope that we've tried to stay true to that spirit of the young quartet, the young Tokács quartet.
You mean not taking it too seriously?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the trouble is quartets is a very intense way of life. You spend more time with each other than you do with your families, and you have to work very hard. The line between sounding good and not sounding very good is a thin one, and you're always working to... So it is serious work, but these are people, and Jerry is very much part of that spirit, who have good senses of humour, and we try not to take ourselves too seriously. I think having four people that you're always travelling around with, you know, it's a little different than being a soloist. If you're four of you in a minivan for 5 hours driving before you play a concert, then... everyone needs to lighten up a little bit and just, you know, have some fun. Otherwise, it would be unbearable.
Yes, I would think so. And yeah, just to have that that sense of camaraderie, but a little perspective, a little distance. Like, and I was thinking that too. That you know, when you began, you were young, and they had been going for almost 20 years by then. So quite a cultural shift for you.
Well, and a cultural shift for both of us. I mean, I mentioned in the early chapters of the book, I talk some about that kind of linguistic issue that they had to start rehearsing in English. It was hard for them, and if they ever were feeling something really strongly in rehearsal, then they would just go back into Hungarian because it was so hard to talk in English. I learnt a very colourful variety of Hungarian swear words, and also fairly useless Hungarian phrases that I was, you know, would pick up that actually weren't very helpful. I mentioned in the book the expression "nagyon szép," which means very nice. Not much room for that in a rehearsal conversation. Whereas I learned quickly "megetszer," which means again, once again. That was a much more useful word. So yeah, there was a kind of meeting and a lot of flexibility in terms of trying to come together with our different languages and different backgrounds. But I think that's the wonderful thing about string quartets as pieces of music. They bind people together, and they have to. And you see that right from the beginning of when they were written, when Beethoven, it was because of these pieces that he wrote that were so difficult that created a kind of a new model of professional chamber music making. It was already going on a little bit in other places, in London, for example, but It was after the Opus 59 quartets that the person who commissioned them, Count Razumovsky, recognizing that they were so hard, that he appointed his first quartet in residence at his palace. And that's a sort of model that, in a way, in a different way, continues today. I mean, we have our own residence, not at the palace, but at the University of Colorado in Boulder. So I think this chamber music, and particularly string quartets, are a nice symbol of human endeavor and kind of coming together, and the difficulties of working very closely and collaborating in that way, the ups and downs of that, and how do you make it work. And at some level, you make it work if you're lucky enough to be with three other compatible people, and at some level you make it work because the music demands it of you and you don't have a choice. You know that when you're on stage in the evening playing for an audience, it has to be unified interpretation. There's no room for any kind of roadblocks.
Right, personal or yeah, musical or otherwise, right? It's quite an amazing journey to go on, and it's fun to go on it with you in your book. I was wondering, you have, the Takash has Grammy Awards and multiple different awards for your recordings. Is there a direction you're headed now? Do you have the future path all worked out?
You know, for recordings, we've been doing more quintet repertoire recently. So I think the next release will be it's a mixture. It's a late Dvorak quartet, the A-flat major. Wonderful piece. And then the viola quintets, which was written around the same time as the American quartet when he was in Spillville. And that's with the second violist, is a friend of ours, great player, Lawrence Power, English violist. So we have tended to do projects that have a quartet and a quintet in them. Recently, we just released the César Franck piano quintet with Marc-André Hamelin and coupled that with the Debussy. And we'll be doing some other quintets, piano quintets, Dohnányi piano quintets, coming up in a year and a half. We're not doing any recording this year because we're doing lots of Beethoven cycles. And we already have recorded the Beethovens, but they take so much physical and emotional energy, we're taking a little breather from recording.
It's wonderful that you're back to Beethoven after the recordings, which were 2005, weren't they?
We did them sort of over from about 2000 to 2004. And what's nice is that Decca actually later this year will re-release them as a box set, the whole. They've never come out in one, so it will be possible at a not too extortionate price to get all of them in one box set, I think, later this year.
Edward Dusenberry, thank you so much for your time today, and have a wonderful concert tonight. And thank you for Beethoven.
Thanks. I enjoyed talking.
You can hear Edward Dusenberry and the rest of the Takash Quartet in an all-Beethoven program this Sunday at 7 p.m. on WCRB in Concert. For more information and to hear past episodes of WCRB in Concert on demand, visit our website, classicalwcrb.org. That's where you can also hear Boston Symphony performances on demand and hear the latest episode of The Answered Question. You can subscribe to The Answered Question at iTunes or through your favorite podcast app, and you'll also find TAQ on WCRB's Facebook, Twitter, and SoundCloud pages. Thank you to the guests on this podcast, including Sacario Ramo and Edward Dusenberry, as well as the staffs of the Boston Symphony and Rockport Music for their help in making these conversations possible. Thanks also to my colleague, Alan McClellan. I'm Brian McCreath. Thanks for listening.